Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Looking for a little Hollywood-style fun? Check out Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways exclusively at Chumba Casino. There's 10,000 ways to play. Get spinning for free at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Nancy Guthrie, the 84-year-old mother of Today Show host Savannah Guthrie, was taken from her Tucson home against her will. Investigators have confirmed forced entry, DNA evidence belonging to Nancy, and purported ransom notes demanding Bitcoin sent to multiple media outlets. The chaos storm is large right now. People saying this, people saying that, people saying this, people backing up what they said, people backing away from what they've said. It's the fog of war, as are so many of these cases. The FBI is involved. No suspects have been identified. To understand what a case like this looks like when it finally lands in the courtroom, from both the prosecution and the defense side, we're joined by attorney Eric Faddis. This is a case where I'm having a hard time wrapping my mind around where to even begin talking about on it, because it's just so breaking and so moving, and it's not, I don't want to just do here's the latest, here's the breaking, but what's the angle? How is this going to play out long term? So I want to talk about some of the aspects of it that have begun to flow in. We're going to start with talking about the ransom notes that have come in, sent to media outlets. We don't know if these things are legitimate, and we're going to take it from that angle of not knowing. TMZ, local Tucson stations, say they've received these ransom notes. It's not an unusual move. It's a little unusual that they're getting them 4 days into this. Eric, what does a choice tell you about the legal exposure a person is putting themselves into by sending out ransom notes, whether they actually have her or not? This could be a rather precocious place to put oneself if it's just for attention.
Oh, 100%. I mean, a law enforcement has to assess the authenticity of these purported ransom notes and whether it is someone who actually has her and is seeking compensation, or if it's someone who is, like you said, trying to get attention. And if you're doing that, you are subjecting yourself to serious potential criminal and civil liability, like obstruction of justice, false representations to a police officer, things like that interfere with the investigation and may throw it off track when it is very serious and they need to find this woman and who has taken her. There could be some civil issues when it comes to fraud and things like that too. So if the person's doing this and they don't actually have her, stupid move.
Yeah, I mean, it could end up being a story unto itself at the end of the day if these have nothing to do with her. I mean, and we do see this in cases. You do see people claiming responsibility. We're in an age where it's not drop the bag of money off at the park by the palm tree. It's Bitcoin. It's here's what we want you to give us. According to the outlets that receive the notes, they haven't gone into any sort of detail. They've turned them over to law enforcement. They say that in the notes, there is information in there about what Nancy may have been wearing. Things that on the surface one may go, well, maybe only the kidnapper would know this. We don't know the answer to that question. We don't know if it is information that they only knew or if they just put a bunch of generic stuff in there that one could speculate that maybe only they would know. So how does one go about gleaning the credibility of one of these notes? Because the only people who would know what was going on with Nancy in her house in the middle of the night was Nancy and whoever did this. The authorities don't necessarily know here's exactly what she was wearing. Here's, you know, all of the details that a kidnapper might claim to say, hey, this is this. No one else would know it. How do you even corroborate that, really?
discussed, you know, you got to look at a number of things. One, the form of the message. Was this a physical letter or was it an electronic correspondence, like an email? If it was an email, certainly there are digital forensics analyses that, that can be conducted, but sometimes those can be thwarted by anonymous measures and people sending emails anonymously. If it's a letter itself, you know, you look at if it's handwritten, you look, of course, analyze it with a handwriting expert, try to compare it to any known samples, if there are any. And on top of that, you look at the details that are within the letter. Are they corroborated? Is it really what Nancy was wearing? Does it detail things about inside the home or items inside the home or something of that nature that might be consistent with what the investigation has found? And then from there, it's a very delicate process to try to address that letter. And, you know, do you negotiate with those folks? Do you try to find them and send the FBI after them? There's a lot of choice points that law enforcement is going to have.
Well, and how do you go after somebody like this? You know, I mean, whoever is sending these notes out has insulated themselves in a way that they're not going to be found. And Bitcoin is a way of purchasing or sending money that is not necessarily traceable either.
But a lot of the Bitcoin is traceable, though. There is a permanent log for these things. So that's where I'm confused on things. I don't know if either of you could clarify this. There's somebody in my world that knows crypto inside and out, and I forgot to ask about it. So that was my failure. But from what I know about crypto is everything is traced. There is a permanent trail.
There's ways where it cannot be traced.
Gotcha.
Yeah, my understanding is there is a blockchain that is supposed to show sort of the sequence of transactions, that kind of thing. But the source behind who's making those transactions can be made anonymous, is my understanding.
Yeah, there's ways of doing this completely in an untraceable way, which is why they're doing it through Bitcoin. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken that route to begin with. When you have that, you're sitting there, you're wanting your mother back, you're wanting, you know, this to end. I mean, you want her back, but how do you know? I mean, and now obviously the family has made a video. We saw that just last night. Savannah and her siblings are on it, you know, asking, you know, for her safe return, saying essentially, you know, they're willing to talk to, negotiate, but they're willing to make this a back and forth, a dialogue, and not just here's this demand. Okay. But how do you know who you're dealing with? And they're asking for proof of life. So I guess that's our next step to see if we actually get that or not. From a legal aspect here, I don't know, have you ever been in a situation, Eric, where a client has someone who's being held for ransom? Or even if you haven't been, how would you advise someone to go forward on something like that? Because in one possibility, you could burn a lot of money very quickly that goes absolutely nowhere. And obviously someone's life is at stake here. So, you know, money doesn't matter. But I mean, it does at the same point of like not destroying your life savings for a scam. There's a lot to consider.
Tony, I haven't personally dealt with this, but I have a friend who is a crisis negotiator at the Lakewood Police Department here in Colorado. And he's told me a little bit about how this game can work. And really, you know, part of it is engaging the person who is sending these ransom letters and really trying to connect on a human level, which might seem odd. We're talking about somebody who kidnapped an 80-year-old person as requesting money. But there are techniques that can be pursued. And in fact, the family could seek out some sort of crisis negotiator to kind of intervene and oversee these purported exchanges if they have any that come to light. So that's one option, is to get a specialist involved. I know the FBI and former FBI folks are also crisis negotiators, some of them.
How common are these ransom type kidnappings? And to me, this sounds like something you'd see in Scooby-Doo. You know, this is like a Saturday morning cartoon thing. I just don't feel like we hear this very often.
Coming up next, right after today, an all-new Scooby-Doo where Nancy Guthrie is kidnapped. I mean,
doesn't it feel that way?
It does. I mean, yeah. I mean, it feels, because it's rare.
Yeah.
Yeah, very rare. I don't think I've ever dealt with it. I'm not aware of any recent Colorado cases that have dealt with it. But sometimes these things happen below the radar. Sometimes the press and even the police might not be involved, and so you might not hear about them. They might be at least somewhat more frequent than is publicly reported.
Gotcha.
I would imagine, you know, there people are got to be, you know, combing, or investigators need to be combing through every single interaction that she's had in the last, you know, however long period of time. I'm wondering, and I don't know that anybody knows the answer to this because it is such a rare occurrence, but I'm wondering if we're going to find signs or anything within patterns of communication with certain people that would lead anybody to think something odd is going on here. I mean, everything, I guess, is going to be up for guess here, or up for investigation and up for scrutinizing for some sort of motive behind who would want to kidnap an 84-year-old woman.
Right. Yeah. And you know, in thinking about it, it's not something that the kidnapper probably just decided that day and picked a random person and went and did. Yeah. Instead, there was probably some planning involved. And so you got to look at, was there anyone sort of staking out the property? If there are any Ring cameras or exterior surveillance video from weeks prior to this, and you know, a vehicle that appears there that doesn't belong within that neighborhood. You also look at digital footprint. You know, was there someone who, you know, followed Nancy on social media, if she has it, on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and everything, like a week before, to try to gain intel to commit this crime. There are certain avenues that you have to investigate to try to sort of retrace what happened beforehand and what led up to this.
Let's talk about the law enforcement response to this thus far. Initially, we have some statements that get walked back. She was harmed at the home. She was taken from her bed. I didn't mean to say she was taken from her bed. I just meant the house. The scene gets released. Brian Enten is there with his photographer the other day, taking pictures like right at the entrance, and the blood that appears to be blood, at least anyway, right, you know, in front of where the doorbell was that's been removed. I mean, and I'm not faulting Brian. He's reporting the fact that there was no one there to say, hey, this is a closed off crime scene, because it wasn't a closed off crime scene. That has kind of shocked me. They've since come back and now put police tape all over it, and they've closed it as a crime scene, but it's been contaminated. People have wandered around. What are you getting the sense of in terms of how this investigation is going? I know we now have some more federal agencies that are investigating this as well, and on top of it, but I don't know. I'm always blown away at the early hours, and I know chaotic things happen, but for the love of God, this just seems like police work 101. Yep. Secure your fucking crime scene.
Yeah, I saw that interview with Brian, Tony, and it looked like to me they obtained video of what appeared to be some red droplets outside the front door. But when you're talking about a crime scene, of course you can't have it contaminated. You need to look at every inch of that surrounding area. Are there any twigs that appear to have been or bushes that appear to have been tampered with or pushed down or something like that? You look for footprints, you look for DNA, you look for items that might have been dropped, you look for anything at the scene that might be askew. But when you have, you know, a bunch of people just kind of moseying around over there, that's going to really make that investigation difficult.
And it makes you get into conspiracy. I mean, it opens the window for so many issues. And at the end of the day, it just seems like it's incompetent so many times. It's like, well, Herb thought it was good, so we said, then we secured it later. Like, yeah, a little late, guys. I know they're working hard and they're trying to find her. Great and wonderful. But again, it's like, what the hell is going on? How are we dropping the ball like this right out of the gate in an area where whoever did this would have left some semblance of their identity, as minute as it may be, as picked up microscopically as it may be? All the more reason why you can't have the scene open and you can't later go, oh shit, I should have done that. That to me has been rather baffling. What does it say to you? And this is some unconfirmed reporting from other sources, that the Nest cameras, from what we understand, they were Nest cameras, they were destroyed. That there was, from what I understand, there was one in the front of the house, which is, I believe, where we saw where Brian was with his reporting. And I think there was possibly another one. The reporting is that they were smashed, which I find an interesting move, considering everything goes to the cloud. These things, they may store a little bit on resident memory, then it's loaded to the cloud. So if you smash it, maybe you're going to stop it from getting whatever it has at that exact moment. So not completely, I guess, crazy. But the idea of, you know, you're going to take out the cameras and that's going to erase your traces, that speaks to me of someone who isn't up on technology in the least, that you're smashing the camera. I know. What does that say to you?
Well, you know, I recently had a case involving Nest cameras. It was alleged homicide. And those cameras detail and log and save, at least in my case, like every small action that was ever taken on them. When they were disabled, that's logged. When there was some sort of modification in settings, when there was when it picked up something, those things are logged. And so to just kind of, you know, whatever, take a hammer to it, that seems a little bit rudimentary. And probably not a person who has a full understanding of how these digital systems work in the modern age. You know, it still could have picked up significant evidence, and the you know, hammer smash or whatever, that's not going to insulate somebody necessarily.
But does then you've sound- got somebody asking for Bitcoin. So yeah, what the exactly, hell is going on here?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Does that sound like someone to you that's asking for Bitcoin?
You know, I'm not terribly familiar with cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
You know, I know that it is an emerging trend, including in criminal cases, and it appears to be a present element here.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's not to say that it couldn't be a possibility, but it's like the two, they seem rather different. If you're asking for Bitcoin, I think you might have a general idea of how the Nest cameras function. And hitting it with a hammer, not necessarily going to do a whole lot other than you're breaking it from filming anything going forward. It's not necessarily going to be to get rid of the data that exists beforehand. So, I mean, it may not capture you leaving. So, I mean, that might just be the simplicity of it. It might just be, then it's not going to see me when I leave. I'm going to, you know, take it out. I don't know. It's not adding up as part of the equation of, if this is the perpetrator, is that the perpetrator? I don't know. There's a lot of chaos here, a lot of questions. We maybe end up talking, this may be two totally different cases we're talking about at the end of the day, with somebody asking for Bitcoin and may not actually having her. It'll be very fascinating to see where this goes. And at the end of the day, we certainly hope that that she is found alive and that she's able to get back safely. A horrible case. Eric Faddis, thank you for your insight there. Give us your thoughts on the comments section, either on YouTube or on Substack, on where you think this case is going. Are we missing anything? Is there anything that's standing out to you that hasn't been talked about? Let us know there in the comments. Let's talk about another case that we've been following very closely here. It's been 2 months now since Charity Bialis and her 6-year-old twins were found shot to death in Bonanza, Arkansas, and still no arrest. Charity's father has told me directly here at Hidden Killers that he viewed her body at the morgue and says she was shot twice. That's his words. It is not an official announcement from any source as of yet, other than him. In the chest and in between the eyes is what he says. And if accurate, 2 gunshot wounds would seem to eliminate any possibility of suicide. So why hasn't anyone been charged yet? In this case, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, with us to help break this down. Let's start with this. The father himself saying he viewed the body, shot twice, chest between the eyes. No official autopsy has been released, but if it is accurate from what he is telling me, and that I have also kind of vetted out through some other sources as well, it does seem to be pretty accurate. Why no charges yet? We kind of rule, I think that might rule out suicide, would it not? Are there any documented cases of 2-shot suicides that you can think of, Eric?
Never heard of it, Tony. I haven't seen such a case. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of the case out east. Gosh, the name escapes me.
Greenberg.
But it was, what's one?
Greenberg.
That's the one. Yeah, Ellen Greenberg, exactly, yeah. Where she had all these stab wounds, including to the back of her neck, multiple stab wounds over her body. The authorities said this was a suicide. Everyone said, what the hell are you talking about? Mm-hmm. And so it would seem like this fact pattern, if accurate, with the two shots in the head and also in the chest, would rule out suicide. So if it's not suicide and it's not an accident, which it doesn't appear to be with the other two twins dead, then it's probably a homicide. And if so, what direction does that point?
And that's the question, because I was seriously questioning, because we haven't heard the official cause of death yet. We haven't heard I've heard it from his dad. I've sourced it through a couple other places too. When the official comes out, I'm going to be guessing that's what we're going to be seeing. But if it is in fact the two shots, I had been wondering, you know, was this someone who took their own life and the lives of their children because of being upset? The day prior, there had been a divorce hearing. It was getting finalized. He, meaning the husband, was awarded, I believe, somewhere around 70-30 custody, 70 in his favor. The man who had been villainized by charity all summer long, publicly left and right, saying essentially he's going to kill me. This is dangerous. This is horrible. And then she ends up dead a day after the ruling on the divorce and in custody. But it didn't not go in his favor. That's what gets me about it. It wasn't like, and we're going to punish you even more. We're going to continue to uphold this order of no contact. No, it was, guess what? You get your kids back and you get them more than she does. That's why I was like, God, did she end her own life out of being very upset by this ruling? That would logically make sense in a horrible, horrible, you know, very, you know, broken brain sort of way. It doesn't make a lot of sense that someone who is awarded what they supposedly want then goes and murders. And no one has been charged here yet. He's maintaining his innocence. He's saying he's cooperating with police. There is that, there's a track record. There are charges in the past of abuse that have been pled down and such. But you have all this going on. The dynamics are just utter chaos. From your experience, what is this 2-month gap and no arrest tell you about where this investigation might be as of right now, knowing all these odd factors that are at play?
Sadly, Tony, I think it might be dwindling. You know, when we have this amount of time that has gone by in a triple homicide involving two young children, you know, that's a priority for law enforcement, of course. And I like to believe they're doing everything in their power to properly investigate that. Since 2 months have gone by, I think the likelihood that this thing is going to be solved gets lower by the day. And, you know, certainly a tragic circumstance for the family in that community, especially if it isn't solved.
And that's the thing. There's another interesting aspect to this. There's actually a lot of interesting aspects to this that go back and they look incriminating. Because something looks that way doesn't mean it actually is. But certainly there's a lot that is to be considered here. Go back to 2012. Randall Bialas, this is the husband. His second wife, Shauna, also found dead with a gunshot wound to the forehead, ruled a suicide. The case was reopened in 2021 after statements were made to police, statements that are now disputed, and then closed again because evidence has been destroyed by court order in 2014. If you're defending someone and there's a prior death in their history that was ruled a suicide, how is that going to factor into your approach? And again, obviously, Randall's not been charged with anything. He hasn't had to defend himself publicly to anything yet, but this is what's in the ether. This is what the public is judging him on right now. He can stay quiet. He doesn't have to say anything at all, but my God, these optics look horrible.
Yes, they do.
you know, it sort of seems reminiscent of other circumstances like Black Widow murderers who kill multiple spouses over time, often for a financial incentive or some other reason. But that pattern, or at least that history, is concerning, of course. And I've got to imagine law enforcement is looking in a targeted fashion at that person. But if the prior incident was ruled a suicide, you know, some people can be in a terribly unlucky scenario where this thing essentially happens to them twice, possibly, in life. The odds of that are pretty low, but possible.
Especially method of how the other one died. Especially if it screams really similar to this one, it just, well, that's a head scratcher.
Well, and then you have with the previous one, you have also some people interpreting an affidavit saying that that Randy Powell, who's the dad, there's Randall and there's Randy in this case.
Oh,
Randy is dad. Yeah. That's who we've been talking to. There's allegations that he supposedly it's on police body camera, gave police said that he claimed that Charity had confessed to him that she had pulled the trigger on the second wife. He denies that, says that this was interpreted incorrectly, that was never said. He never said it on camera. He's been asking for them to prove it, to come up with the body cam footage. We haven't seen it. No one's seen it. It's just a claim as of right now. It looks rather odd if this ever was said and they can't back it up. I don't know. There's just chaos. There's utter chaos. He said, she said, we're going to say they said this, but we can't prove that they said it. It's everywhere. And then to add to the mix of all of it, 3 days after the bodies are found, family photos, children's artwork, a necklace with the twins' names discovered in a dumpster in an apartment complex tied to Randall Bialas through his divorce documents or through the documents of the alleged abuse that were filed. When we go back and look at those documents, a place of residence, the apartment complex, is where these items were found in that dumpster 3 days after the death. Could be an innocent explanation, I guess. Could be, you know, I'm angry. This looks horrible. People are going to think I did this. I want to get rid of her shit. I don't know. But all of this is just, there's a lot of pieces here, but not a lot of answers yet. And as we know, the longer investigations go, you know, the less likely it gets that we're going to get anywhere. Are you surprised that we don't have more answers as of yet with so many seemingly puzzle pieces that are at least out of the box and on the table?
You know, like you said, there are so many moving parts in this, you know, sort of torrid history here. But that can give rise to leads. Those things, excuse me, while being difficult to get to the bottom of, at least can give hints, can have evidence and be signs in terms of which direction to look. And certainly some very curious circumstances here. The discarding of those children's belongings after this, horrible murder. It happened to be proximal to one of the people who we would look at as a potential main suspect. Not saying he did it, but you start to piece things together and you start to say, well, you know, we hope they're taking a really close look at these folks.
It's starting to stack.
You know, what's weird about it to me and those items, my initial reaction was what I just kind of stated was, okay, if he didn't do it, And I'm not trying to defend him because I have no idea. I don't know who did this. I'm just trying to look at it through the prism of everybody involved. If he didn't do this, and you've all year long, she's been on a marketing mission, basically saying he's going to kill me, he's horrible, blah, 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 which she was. She did that. And then she dies. And if you had nothing to do with it, I'd be a little pissed because you've been saying, I'm going to kill you. And now you're dead. Now everyone's going to look at me. And if I didn't do it, God, yeah, I'd be a little angry, especially if there had been manipulation and other issues with that dynamic of that relationship back and forth. And the kids are dead. I don't know how I'd even be processing that. I'd probably be nuts if my kids were murdered. That seems to not be happening here. But my thought was, okay, he may be angry and getting rid of some of the evidence of charity existing in his life, but it's kids' stuff. It's the kids' stuff that was thrown away. There was some charity, but there was kids' stuff that was in there. And we don't know if he threw it away. We don't know where, how it got there. I don't know who would have it unless somebody took it out of charity's house as a memento as they were killing them. And like, oh, I got this, I'm going to dump this too. And it wasn't. But it's in the apartment complex of the guy. I mean, or that's a setup, or that's someone that's really, really setting this up, trying to make it look like it is him. But again, it's the kids' stuff. If it's you, if it's him that did this, I'm not saying it is, but if throwing out the kids' stuff really shows a disconnect of emotion, a disconnect of emotion that would certainly have to exist if you're going to take out your own kids, which again, that to me is another very hard one to wrap your mind around. Even if you don't want to be responsible for kids, taking them out, your own damn flesh and blood, because you have beef with the wife. It's all very hard to wrap my mind around of there's not a simple direction here for this.
Oh, right. And I mean, you know, like you said, throwing away the wife stuff is one thing. You know, I went through a divorce recently and I discarded a lot of that historical stuff.
Which is a normal thing. Yeah.
Right. You know, but the kids, you know, especially if your kids were murdered, I would think you might want to keep that stuff. You might want to cherish that. That might be your last remaining memories and keepsakes for this, for these children who are yours. And so why would a person throw those away? Is it a frame job? Is it something else? A lot of questions still swirling around.
Nothing makes sense in this. Nothing makes sense in this. At all. And either that's because whoever is behind this is, you know, they really knew how to throw people off the scent here, or it's a lot of weird things that are all lining up and really just look extremely chaotic. And it is as chaotic as it actually is. So many questions. We're going to keep following it. Hopefully there is some new revelation sometime soon, but you know, we'll keep our fingers crossed on that. Let's go over to one more case here that certainly a lot of questions. The unsealed affidavit in the McKee case, the murder of the Tappies, has dropped like a bomb. 8 years of alleged obsession, surveillance footage of McKee in the Tappies' yard while they were out of town, stolen license plates, a cell phone that went conveniently dark during the murder window, and witnesses and statements describing threats that read like a countdown to violence. Prosecutors aren't just charging murder here. They're painting a portrait of premeditation that spans nearly a decade. Criminal defense attorney Eric Faddis, former prosecutor, joining us to break down what this affidavit reveals about the prosecution's strategy, where the defense might push back, and what the firearm specifications, automatic weapon or silencer, signal about where this case is headed. Eric, let's start with the details of the surveillance footage that everyone is talking about, showing McKee walking through the Tappies' yard on December 6th or 7th, while Spencer and Monique were at the Big Ten Championship game in Indianapolis. This is a big one from a prosecution standpoint. How powerful is evidence like this of a pre-offense? The guy is in the yard 300 some miles away from where he lives, 4 hours. They're not home. I can't think of anything creepier one could be doing and be caught doing when you're charged with a murder. Probably the last thing that he wants to be noticed for on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon doing.
Right. I mean, if you're the prosecutor, this is prime evidence of premeditation. This is evidence of someone casing the joint. You know, you would argue that, hey, he would be there. He would be learning about the layout of the property. He'd be learning about where the doors are, where the windows are. He'd be perhaps thinking about, how can I access this property? How can I get in there and do what I intend to do? What other reason? He has no other legitimate reason to be there. What would he be there doing that is not nefarious? If you're the prosecutor, that's the horse you're riding.
I don't know how you could spin that one. And we haven't seen the footage yet. So we you know, they're telling us it's him. I'm curious as to how obvious it is him, or if there's going to be any sort of room for argument there going, yeah, it might be, but you can't really definitively say it's the guy. Nonetheless, somebody in the yard, it's going to be certainly part of the story and part of the evidence. Part of the story, part of the public evidence right now, you could say, are the statements that have come from Monique's friends and family. Statements that claim that he said that he could kill her at any time. He'd find her and buy the house next to her, that she'll always be his wife. These are dark, horrible statements, but they are statements from friends, from family. We don't have them, as far as we know, directly from Monique. Maybe they exist somewhere in the ether. Maybe they're in emails. Maybe they're in text messages. And if they are, great. That would be very powerful in this case. Let's say they're not. Let's say it's just their friends and family speaking up in defense of Monique. And it may be things that she actually said, but do statements like that typically make it into court when it is, you know, third party statements? It's hearsay, essentially.
Yeah, that's going to be a real evidentiary impediment potentially, because it's likely three levels of hearsay. Mm-hmm. The declarant was McKee allegedly, and then he said it to Monique, who said it to another person. That third person, that friend, would have to be called to testify. But that middle piece of hearsay coming from Monique, I'm not sure that there's a way to sidestep that prohibition on hearsay evidence. You know, there is a sort of catch-all exception in terms of statements that just appear to be overly reliable. Sometimes a judge hangs their hat on that. But there's a chance that those statements don't even see the light of day inside that courtroom.
Are you surprised that he got caught, or that he thought he wasn't going to get caught? I think that may be more the operable question, because there are elements to this where it seems like, you know, he was trying to act in a, you know, nondescript way where he was not going to be noticed. He switched license plates. He did certain evasion tactics that show, okay, this guy, he's on a mission to take this plan and execute it and not be caught. But then there's such obvious things too, like being caught on the security camera at the beginning of the month. There's ways he got caught. Your phone going dark for those hours. There's a lot of things that look very suspicious here. Is this someone who really thought this out well when we're looking at a criminal who's executing a plan like this? Is this someone who sat there, planned this out, and really executed it to the best of their ability? My other thought on this, is this someone who got a little lazy, who's been doing this for a very long time without really being caught? And finally, their comfort with stalking caught up to them.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, what it reminds me of, Tony, you know, we all probably have encountered a person who thinks they're the smartest dude in the room, but they're not always. And you know, this guy, McKee, was a doctor, and perhaps he had this inflated confidence, this inflated sense of competency. And, hey, I'm going to outsmart these people. I'm a doctor. I've been getting away with this stalking for 8 years, and they haven't, you know, dinged me on it yet. I wonder if it's a person who thought they were smarter than they were, got complacent, and then also was an amateur criminal. I'm not aware of any criminal history that he has. And so going into, you know, a different industry that you don't really know much about, you're a novice at that point, even if you think you're an expert.
Well, and we know, obviously, he has a history here of evading responsibility. He has the civil cases that were against him for malpractice. They were not able to serve him with papers on this. They eventually had to do the serving of it through local
in the
newspaper because they ran out of options here. So this is someone who has a track record of showing he doesn't want to face responsibility for his actions. How do you think that's going to play in this case? Do you think that that is something that will be allowed to be introduced into the case as evidence, as, you know, other acts that are avoiding responsibility, similar to what we saw in the Murdaugh case with the bad acts, with the financial responsibilities. Obviously, they weren't directly tied, but if you were to look at motivation tied together, frustration building up, and then someone acting on that frustration and the outcome being a dead family, I'm wondering if these are going to play into the bigger picture when this eventually does get in front of a jury.
Yes, my recollection is that McKee had to be extradited. That shows evasion. It shows perhaps a consciousness of guilt, fleeing the scene, driving hundreds of miles afterwards, turning your phone off, that kind of thing. And the prosecutor might argue, hey, if defense is going to say that these were all mistakes or innocuous measures or whatever, we want to bolster our argument of consciousness of guilt by showing that he's evaded the legal process before. And in fact, he has sort of maneuvered himself in doing so. And this is not new to him. So it's not an accident. It's not a mistake. This was intentional, volitional conduct, and it's evidenced by his past evasion of the legal process. There's a chance that the prosecutor tries to argue that. I think that was a toss-up for the judge, but they might make the argument.
And to that end of the consciousness of guilt, so I've read conflicting reports, correct me if I'm wrong, the phone wasn't powered off. They're saying no activity, and we know that people choose their words very carefully, that it wasn't powered off. They showed no activity. So could he have had it in a Faraday bag or on airplane mode, showing that I'm trying to evade being tracked in some way?
It very well could be. I mean, there are a number of measures one can take to try to ensure that their phone is not pinging off cell towers and logging activity and that kind of thing. So it doesn't necessarily have to be turned off in order for it to be evasive conduct.
It was at the doctor's office is where it was.
So it was sitting there for sure.
We don't know if it was, I don't know if it was on or off or in airplane mode, but it was there. It was at his office.
Okay. Yep. Thank you for that clarification.
Yep. That's where it's been for those 17 hours. 'Cause he went and picked it back up from there. It kind of reminds me of Koberger in a bit, in a way of, this isn't going to look suspicious unless there's a track record of him leaving his phone at his office, for all of that time. And that's the question. We just don't know the answer to that. Okay. Pure conjecture, Eric, on this, and we'll wrap up on this. This character, Michael McKee, is this a character that you predict is going to treat this like a game, kind of like Koberger did, where it's going to go down to the last second? The evidence is overwhelming. I'd say it's more overwhelming in this than even the Koberger case. Is he just going to take this to the very last minute, to the buzzer, and then go, you got me? If he finds no way to legally maneuver this, who knows where this could be legally maneuvered? Is they're going to go after the crossing the T's and the dotting the I's and everything that could have gone wrong procedurally in the investigation, and they're going to try and get shit thrown out where they can. Same thing Koberger did. And to who knows what type of degree of success they're going to have on that, probably not much. But is this someone who is just, it's a game, they're going to run out the clock? Or do you think he's going to take this thing all the way through trial? Because what does he have to lose at the end of the day? It's not his money.
Yeah, Tony, I certainly see some parallels between McKee and Koberger. One is that they are both in higher education. Koberger was getting his PhD in criminology. McKee is a vascular surgeon. Sometimes there's an inflated ego, an inflated sense of confidence there. And on top of that, he has gotten away with this for a while. So he might feel a sense of entitlement. Some doctors feel that anyway. And on top of that, if you've been getting away with stalking for 8 years, you might feel like in this sort of distorted reality of your own mind that, hey, I'm entitled to this, and I shouldn't be caught for this. And they don't have what I think they need to have. And so I think he's going to fight it probably till the very end on this. Even when his attorneys are saying, like, bro, this is a tremendous problem. He's like, no, you guys are wrong. I'm right. I just see him being that type of person. I don't know him, but that's just my impression.
Wow.
What do you do? I mean, if you're the attorney for this, I mean, you signed up, you're in the seat. This is a paid attorney. This isn't a state public defender. So he is, and it's a high, so there is money being spent. He is spending his own money. I should say that. But what do you do with something like that? I mean, if you go into this case thinking, well, this you know, it may end in some sort of an agreement or settling it in some way, shape, or form without going to trial. But you got to be prepared that this thing does go to trial. So to imagine that she's, you know, preparing that this could get there. But what do you do when you get there? Because we don't know how this is going to play out. It's probably several years down the road. If you're sitting there almost in the same position Ann Taylor was at the very last minute, and it ended in the way that it did, how do you defend somebody like this when it's literally everything is stacked up against the wall? You've gone through all the motions, all the hearings for evidence, and it still looks like it's, yeah, you're screwed. Yeah. You can't just back out and be like, change my mind.
Right. No, you certainly can't. The judge would likely not allow that. You know, I think that the defense attorney is looking at this on two fronts. One is challenging the merits of the charges, whether the guy did it or whether there's a defense. And on the other side, the constitutionality of any police conduct. So, you know, you kind of go on trying to challenge every little thing the police did, try to get evidence kicked and try to improve your case in that fashion. On the other front, you've got to be thinking about what is the plausible alternative explanation, if there is one, that I can present to this jury. Is it an alternative suspect? Is it a mental health thing? Is there some kind of plausible alternative explanation that I can at least give to a jury that could plant that seed of doubt in their mind that they might find reasonable? I think defense seems to be coming up short so far, at least in terms of publicly available information, but we still got a lot of game to play.
Yeah. There is a lot, and we'll continue to watch it. We're still in the very beginning stages of this nightmare, and the nightmare for all of their friends and family. Be sure to give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack, hiddenkillers.substack.com, or on our YouTube. The links are there in the description. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting the podcast or watching us, whether it's YouTube or Apple Podcasts, whatever it may be. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage on these cases. Until next time, for Eric, for Stacy, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at chumbacasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better. With new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect, the fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.